So I welcome everyone to our June session of Advancing Advocacy. Before we get started, I will just remind everyone that we are recording. So just keep that in mind as you, particularly when we get into the Q&A at the end. So you, if you prefer not to identify yourself or anything like that, we are recording. So tonight we have Dr. Randall Wallace, who will be sharing with us, as you can see on your screen if you're looking at it, Risk Assessment Fundamentals. And I, a topic that I have not learned a whole lot about in the time I've been working on these issues is risk assessment. So I searched out someone who is an expert in the field, and he graciously stepped up to the plate to share with us, really with the intent to tell us, you know, what are risk assessments, how do they work, and just educate us really on the whole process of risk assessments and how they're used. So I am going to turn over the session to Dr. Wallace, and I am going to put everybody on the Q&A mode so that Dr. Wallace will present, and then once we get to the end, we'll be able to put you in a queue for question and answers toward the end of the presentation. So, Dr. Wallace, I'm going to turn it over to you. Oh, but I got to get him back on, don't I?
Hello?
Okay, you should be unmuted now.
Yep, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. good evening. My name is Randy Wallace. Just briefly, I'll go over a little bit of kind of who I am and what I'm intending to do with the session. There's a thing on my screen that says ask a question, and I'm going to X that. I'm assuming that's okay. I am a psychologist, and I've worked in the field of sexual abuse for a little over 25 years. That was my exclusive focus for 25 years, and now I've moved on to adding other things in that. For the last 10 years, I was the director of a program called the Center for the Treatment of Problem Sexual Behavior, which essentially did almost all of the sex offender, or does almost all the sex offender treatment in Connecticut on an outpatient basis. We had about 1,200 clients, and I had 70 staff. And I frankly left there because I don't think it's a good model. I think the field... And part of the reason that I think this is relevant is that risk assessment, one of my concerns is that we don't tend to, as a system, use risk assessment in guiding our treatment, our supervision, in meaningful ways. And so I'll talk about that. One of the overlying principles that I think is important here is that most people who have committed a sexual offense are at a relatively low risk for sexual recidivism. Most of our community concerns are not about people reoffending, but it's about new offenses. So that will be a theme that I come back to and talk quite a bit about. What I'm going to attempt to do today, my understanding is I have 2 hours. This is normally a presentation that I do in 40 hours, so I will cut down a little and talk a little bit faster. So you're going to see a lot of slides that I'm going to skip over. I wanted you to have all the slides so that you'd have additional information. You are also welcome to call me or email me at any time. If there's a way to get that contact information, I'm happy to share it with you. So I'm going to proceed at this point. I'll tell you what we're going to do. Let me start to give you an overview. We're going to talk about three areas of risk. There are three big, when you do a risk assessment for sexual recidivism, you basically look at three areas. One is called static risk. One is called stable dynamic risk, and the third is called acute dynamic risk. So each of those three areas is what I will cover, and I'll cover the major tools that use those. But real briefly, static risk is historical risk. These are items like the age of the person who was convicted of the offense, or the number of victims, or the number of offenses. These are factors that primarily don't change. They are essentially the best predictors of risk. The problem is that they don't tell you what to do with an individual. They only tell you the general level of risk. So when you're intervening in terms of supervision or treatment, a static assessment doesn't tell you anything. It just says this person's low, medium, or high. So all that we know to do is to either spend more time or less time with that person and work more intensely or less intensely, but it doesn't guide us how to intervene with that person, what you specifically want to look at. So the second factor is a dynamic. And the stable dynamic are factors that can change, but they don't change quickly. It can be like your social support. You can lose your social support, or you lose an intimate relationship, or you lose housing, or you obtain a relationship, or housing, or jobs. So they are factors that change, but they don't typically change quickly. The third factor, now let me back up. The stable dynamic factors are important because that's how we intervene in the system. That helps us to, if we were being more effective, to have an individualized treatment plan that would tell us where we should supervise and what factors we should be looking at for supervision. The final one is called acute risk factors. And acute risk factors are dynamic factors that can change, but they happen to be very quick. It's more of a, like, for example, somebody might have an emotional collapse in the moment, or somebody might get really high in the moment, or somebody might get into or lose their partner in the moment. So it's an acute moment. So those are the three areas that we're going to go over, which is static, stable dynamic, and acute dynamic. And I will be reviewing each of those in more detail, but that's basically an overview. Okay. So, first thing about risk. Predicting things is difficult, especially when they are in the future. The important thing to know about risk is that risk is... sorry, I'm getting some feedback.
Something's not right. Try again in a little bit.
Sorry. Risk is, we are not actually very good at doing risk in this field, and the most important reason we are not good at predicting risk for sexual offenders is because their base rates are so low. Most people who sexually offend will not sexually, most people who have sexually offended will not sexually reoffend. So for us to create a tool to predict who will and will not is very poor, because we don't know who's going, because there's not many people who do. Let me give you a simple example. If you were going to create a tool and you had 100 marbles, 50 of those marbles were white and 50 of marbles were black, and you had to create a tool that would guess whether the next marble was going to be white or black, your tool is going to be 50% accurate no matter what you do. You have a 50, because your base rate is 50% white, 50% black. But if you only had 5 marbles that were white and you had 95 marbles that were black, and you had to predict whether you're going to get a black or whether you're going to, when you're going to get a white marble, you would have a very hard time doing it because you've only got a 5% chance of accuracy. That's the problem with sex offender risk, is that we are very poor at knowing who's going to sexually reoffend, and we almost always overestimate the risk for sexual offense. The best risk assessment is the one that fails. And this is an important principle that I like to encourage people, is that a lot of times when we're in the system, what we see is people look at a risk assessment and they kind of statically look at it and go, ooh, bad person. It's what I call kind of the Michael Jordan effect, which is basically when Michael Jordan was playing basketball, a lot of people would kind of look, and even his teammates would kind of hand him the ball, and we'd all sit there and watch and see how wonderful he is. That's what tends to happen with risk assessments, is that people view it as a static thing in concrete, and you just kind of look at it and say, okay, this person is this risk, and that's who they are. The best principle way to look at a risk assessment is, what we're trying to do is to make it fail, because a risk prediction is predicting that somebody is going to sexually reoffend. So rather than statically sitting there and saying, this person's low, medium, or high to offend, we should be saying to ourselves, what do we do to intervene to make sure that this person is happy and healthy and safe in the community? I'm going to go through this very quickly. What evades you more, praise or criticism? And likely what you're going to put in there is praise. I'm going to do this as a very quick precursor, and the reason I put this in there is that one of the things, and I'm not going to go over this in this thing, but one of the things that we miss a lot of times that we don't play to, and the system says they do this, but they don't do a good job, which is playing to the strengths of somebody. What we know in the research, and what I've switched my therapy model to, is there's very little criticism. I do very little time with the offenders talking about their offense, talking about what they've done, because I don't want to rub their nose in what they've already gone through. They've been traumatized enough. So what we see, there's a person named Bill Marshall who's got some really good research on this, that strength-based approaches works much better, and it's much more effective, and the clients are actually engaged. They want to improve. One of the misnomers that we see in the system a lot of times is that the system tends to think people don't want to change. What I think happens a lot of times in the system is that clients are saying, we don't want to change when you criticize us and rub our noses and things and tell us how bad we are and look to try and catch us. When you help us realize the areas that we need work and you play to our strengths, they work much better. And that's certainly been my experience. So I'm going to go over, I'm going to skip this, but this is at some point, there's a good lives model. If you want to know about a good strength-based approach, at some point I can give you some references to that. I am going to skip through this for now. Okay, so let's talk about risk in general, the principle of it. And there's a couple of general principles. When you're thinking about risk, number one factor that's important is that resources are differentially applied depending on the level of risk. Now, this is an important concept. This is, and I'm talking about just general risk, not just for sexual offense, but this is what we know in the literature, which is extremely important. We know that when you have a high-risk person, you should spend more time with that person, more resources, and you should keep them longer. But equally as important, in fact, more importantly when we're dealing with sexual offense, because most of the clients are low-risk clients, you should spend less time with those clients and put less resources in them. We literally, and this is important, we literally make a client more dangerous when they are a low-risk person and you keep them longer in the system and you apply too many resources to them, because we do overkill. And what happens is, I'll give you an example here in Connecticut. Clients are required to go to the state contracted provider, and they're required to do it for the average time here for treatment is 26.9 months for all clients, regardless of the risk. Well, in that time period, clients get frustrated, they lose out on job opportunities, they lose out on all sorts of things, and they spend way too much time, frankly, hanging out with other criminals. So what you want to do, and this is an empirically based factor, is you want to take the high-risk clients, spend more time with them, and put in more resources, and low-risk clients, you actually want to move them out quicker. Second principle, use the risk needs responsivity model, which is you should look at all three factors. One is you should consider static risk, you should consider dynamic risk, and most importantly, or equally importantly, one of the things that the system doesn't tend to do well, they say they do, but they don't tend to, which is you should have a responsivity, which is you should be looking at the client's motivations, their cognitive abilities, their learning stories. For example, a lot of treatment programs, including the program that I used to oversee, had written assignments. Well, we know that most of our clients don't respond well. Either they have learning disabilities and they don't write well, and or they don't find it to be therapeutic. So part of it is a lot of our clients have motivation issues. And this is a really interesting, I'm going to go on some tangents. For example, one of the motivation issues that hits clients pretty heavily is that they are oftentimes judged by how accountable they are. A lot of what treatment and supervision is really an accountability model. The premise is the more accountable you are, the more safe you are. But the research doesn't support that in any way, shape, or form. So one of the things that oftentimes the clients go through in treatment and supervision is they want to know, does this person admit to the offense? And do they accept responsibility? Somehow the notion is that if you admit the offense and you accept responsibility, you're going to be safer. But in fact, there's no research to support that. Very interestingly, Janice Marcus out of California, this is a relatively old treatment, old study, but it's the only large-scale comparison where they did a randomized sample. Half the clients got treatment, half didn't. And what they found was that people who denied their offenses, even though it wasn't statistically significant, reoffended at a lower rate than people who admitted their offenses. So part of this is that we tend to not find the proper motivation for clients. What I do with clients is actually I start them off with trauma work because most of our clients have experienced severe trauma. And what we find is that when you start and talk about the client's own trauma, naturally issues about the offenses and the things that were going on to them more naturally integrate into the conversation. But most treatment models, the first thing they do is they ask the person to admit to their offense and do it in detail, and if they don't, they get heavily criticized for that. Well, that provokes a lot of what we call shame. This is the most stigmatizing label you could ever have. And if you're what's supposed to be treatment focuses on shame-based issues, you're, of course, not going to have good motivation. So the risk-needs responsivity model is one, look at the level of static risk. If they're higher risk, spend more time. If they're lower risk, spend less time. The needs model is specifically look at the dynamic issues for that person. If that person has a hard time with problem solving, then focus on problem solving. If that person has a hard time with intimate relationships, focus on intimate relationships. And that's important because most treatment models, what they do is they do cookie-cutter approach where everybody does the same thing. That's the problem with group therapy, is that it's very difficult to individualize to the needs of the client, which is what the research says you should do in a group model. I'm not saying to get rid of groups, but it's a challenge. And responsivity is to find out the specific needs of the client. How motivated are they? What are their specific needs? And what I find is when you talk first with the client about their needs, they're much more likely to tell you what's going on for them, and you're much more likely to get to where you need to go. Next concept, and this is an important concept in the risk factors, is what's called criminogenic. Now, this is a little abstract and a little difficult, but this is important. And one of the reasons this is important is because the risk factors that I'm going to give to you don't apply to all clients. So what happens a lot of times in the system is that the supervising officer and or the treatment provider and or the victim advocate will start saying, this client has all of these risks and nothing can be addressed. But they have to be relevant to the client. It doesn't just mean, just because it's an empirical, when you have an empirically identified risk factor, all that means is that they've looked at a group of people and a certain percentage of those people had that risk factor. But it doesn't mean that it applies to every single person in all situations. Let me give you an example. I had a client. This client was is an exposer. By the time he'd gotten to me, he was well versed in this. He had been caught for exhibitionism 42 times. Caught, arrested 42 times, and frankly, by the time he left me, he was already at 43. Now, most people think that alcohol is a risk factor for sexual offense. In fact, it is not. Alcohol has a negative correlation with sexually offending. So a lot of people have the misnomer and belief that alcohol causes people to sexual offense. In general, it does not. However, with this client, my exposer, when he drank alcohol, that was a precursor to set him off to expose. Every time he drank, he exposed. It was a perfect correlation. If he drank, his penis was coming out and he was going to expose to somebody. So in that situation, alcohol was criminogenic because it was related to his offending. It's important when people do risk factors and do risk assessments to know what does apply and what doesn't apply to the client. And the way that you do that is this is the pyramid of how you do that. If you look at the bottom, you're going to look at the empirical information. I'm going to give you some data today about what the best empirical data is. So it's kind of like if you've ever seen a Tempur-Pedic mattress, for example. A Tempur-Pedic mattress, imagine the empirical information is like this flat mattress. The client-specific, when you go one level up, is the second question is, does that factor fit for these clients? It's kind of like the handprint inside the mattress. So if all the data is your mattress, the handprint is whether or not it fits for that client. The third thing is, does it fit in that situation? So here's a little quiz. How many children... Prisons are full of child molesters. How many children are molested in a prison? And the answer is essentially nobody. The reason is because in that situation, the people who have sexually offended children don't have access to the children. So the situation becomes important. The client that I was referencing who had done the exposing, if he was drinking alcohol in the sober house that he was in, he didn't expose there. What he would do is he'd go to a park and he would do it there. So the situation became important. This is important because a lot of times I've seen this in Connecticut a lot. They're getting better at this, but they see a lot of this, where you'll see people getting violated on what appears to be like somebody's used marijuana or somebody's used alcohol or used pornography, and all of a sudden officers assume that they need to arrest that person or send them back to prison, when in fact, oftentimes, those factors, they may be things to look at and concerning signs, but doesn't necessarily mean that that person is at risk for sexual recidivism. Okay, so these are some of those empirical, some of the empirical data. I'm just going to go through these quickly. And you can ask yourself this, I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. Do you think deviant sexual interest is a risk factor? Now, the first thing I would ask you, and it's good that you guys are all on mute so you don't have to answer, do you have any deviant sexual thoughts? And the answer is, yes, you do, and so do I, depending on how you consider deviant. We all have sexual thoughts at some level that aren't always appropriate. It doesn't necessarily mean that it would be at a clinical level of deviant sexual interest. When we talk about it deviantly, in a clinical term, what we're talking about is a fixated sexual interest in children or fixated interest in usually some type of force. Those are considered the two primary areas that we're concerned about. And one of the things that's important to know is that the vast majority of people that when deviant sexual interest is present, I've jumped ahead, it is a significant risk factor. But let me come to the next one, which is the vast majority of people who have sexually offended a child do not have sexual interest in children. And this is the vast, vast majority of them. This is where you have to differentiate between what's called a child molester and a pedophile. A pedophile is somebody who has a fixated sexual preference in children. If they had the choice between having sex with an adult or having sex with a child, a pedophile wants to have sex with a child. A child molester is just a behavioral description. That is somebody who has molested a child. And about 70% of the people who have sexually offended are in the child molester category. Even within that, vast majority of them technically are not child molesters. They're really much more in what we call hebephilia area, which is teenage. The most common age range for people to be, for the victim age range, is about 12 or 13 to about 15 or 16. So most of the interests are post-pubescent, where deviant is really prepubescent issues. So when it is present, when somebody has fixated sexual interest in prepubescent children or in rape, then it is a very significant concern. It is a significant risk factor. But the vast majority of people who sexually offend do not have that as a factor. Is lack of victim empathy a strong risk prediction factor? And the answer is no. It's actually not related to anything. This is a whole different training, but I could demonstrate to you very empirically sound how almost nobody, including yourselves or me, has good empathy. It's actually not a skill that we use in the classical sense of that. And it would be a different conversation I'd be happy to have with you at a different time. But victim empathy, the reason this is important is because 98% of all treatment programs have victim empathy as a component in the treatment program when it actually has nothing to do with risk reduction. It actually, most of the time in the research that we have in there, it actually promotes shame in the offender, and it doesn't help. It actually does the reverse. But interestingly, in the research, and this was my doctoral dissertation in this area, that people are not motivated through empathy. They're motivated more through self-concept. How you see yourself is a much more important factor in how you behave with other people than what you're thinking, what's going inside of their head. A little complicated, but I'd be happy to come back and share that with somebody at some point. Is antisocial personality a strong risk prediction factor? Yes, it is. Is force or violence a strong risk prediction factor? No. Antisocial behavior, general criminality, is the number one risk factor for sexual recidivism. Now, importantly, as I'd referenced before, the vast majority of people who have sexually offended are low risk for sexual reoffending. They're also relative to other offenders, general offenders, they are much less likely to have technical violations, and they're much less likely to commit other types of crimes. They don't tend to be a criminal population in any way, shape, or form. There's obviously always exceptions, but they do not tend to go that way. When you have somebody who's sexually offended and they have a high level of either antisocial behavior or criminality, then they are at higher risk. I've already told you this one, denial is not a risk prediction factor. Is general self-regulation, basically keeping your life in place, problem-solving, emotional regulation, those types of things, is that a strong risk prediction, strong factor for risk? And yes, it is. This is actually one of the factors. When I talk to you about the 13 dynamic risk factors, 10 of the 13 have nothing to do with sex. One of the really important things to focus on, and what I try to emphasize to people over and over again, if you want people to be safe in the community, make them happy and make them healthy. If people are happy and healthy, they are much less likely to do anything that's asocial or not good within the community. So general self-regulation, emotional regulation, and the number one thing that I focus on with my clients primarily is emotional self-regulation, because a lot of our clients have a lot of trauma and they're pretty well emotionally misregulated. And frankly, guys aren't very good at dealing with this. I got into doing biofeedback and neurofeedback with my clients because it was a different realm to deal with emotional regulation. If you sit a male down and ask him about how his feelings are, it doesn't work well. If you put a TV screen with a bunch of gadgets and you attach it to him, he's all in. So I tend to do a lot of biofeedback and neurofeedback, mostly because what my experience is that a lot of our clients have a lot of emotional regulation. And this is really important. I'm going to keep coming back to this, that there was a lot of trauma for the vast majority of our clients before the sexual offense ever happened. And equally important, and I'm always interested how hollow this message comes through to people, is that they went, when I tell people in the system, you know, like our clients, these clients have gone through a lot of trauma, they really dismiss it. But think about it. If you lost your freedom, you were given the worst label you could ever done, you've lost your housing, you lost your jobs, you financially have lost things, you've lost your social support, you lost your intimate relationships, and you've hung out for 5 or 6 years in a prison with a bunch of criminals, who wouldn't be traumatized by that? Yet we tend to really dismiss that. And that trauma is important because if people are misregulated, they're more likely to do things that are not going to be good for society. Is the offender also a sexual offense victim? There's a lot of research that, there's a lot of perception on this, but generally what we've seen in the research is that no, they offended, no, they have been victimized at no higher level than the general population. That doesn't mean that there isn't necessarily trauma there. There's a good scale, it's called the ACEs scale, Adverse Childhood Experiences Scale. This is a really good international scale on general trauma. It's 10 items. You can look it up on the internet. It's a good trauma scale. And what we find is a lot of all criminals have fairly high factors on this. With all of my clients, I do 2 trauma assessments with them. I do the ACEs, and I do one called the Trauma Symptom Inventory, which is a nice clinical scale. But the ACEs you can do just online. You can get that. And it's very interesting. Any score over 4 is considered extremely highly traumatized. And it's very rare that I find a client that doesn't get 4 or more on that scale. So it's something you should look at. Is sexual preoccupation a strong risk factor? Yes, sexual preoccupation is. This is becoming a bigger issue, and this is an interesting one. This is a real quick reference. I'm 50, almost 51 years old. So when I was growing up, the average adolescent, I'm not going to admit anything here because I know you guys are recording this, but the average adolescent from 12 to 18 in my cohort, when I was in that age range, looked at essentially 26 images of nudity their entire adolescence, of those entire 6 years. That was it. It was essentially the Playboy you found in the garbage can, and if you got really lucky and you hit the mother lode, it was the National Geographic, right? So that was basically it at that time. Now, Internet pornography makes more money every year than the National Football League, the National Basketball Association, and Major League Baseball combined. So, first of all, we all got into the wrong career, but also, more importantly, the sexual preoccupation is high in our society in general. So it is a risk factor that we're really concerned about, that all sorts of people are being overly exposed to too much sexuality. Now, interestingly, in about the last 15 years, there's actually been a reduction. While we've seen this dramatic increase in sexuality and sexual exposure, there's been about a 10% decrease in child molestation offenses, convictions. I don't think the two are correlated. I don't think that people are looking at more porn, so they're not molesting children. My guess is what's happening, and again, this is simply an anecdotal guess, but it's also being, I have a 10-year-old daughter. I think part of what's happening is that in the last 10 to 15 years, we have gotten into play dates. And play dates is more structured, and you don't have kids just walking out the door. When I was a kid, essentially, when we walked out, the rule of thumb was we had the lamp, the street lamp rule, which is when the street lamps came on at night, you came home. Other than that, you were kind of running around doing what you did in the neighborhoods. It's much more structured, much more supervised. This is important because 90 to 95% of all offenders and victims know each other before the offense. So some form of supervision is a much better prevention that way. Is low self-esteem a strong risk protection factor? No. And this is a little bit parsed. This is kind of a clinical issue. Self-esteem is I'm not feeling good. Now, what does tend to do, and this is kind of parsing, this is a little bit hard to do. Low self-concept is a risk prediction factor. Low self-concept means I'm a bad person. If you look at the two concepts of guilt versus shame, and again, this is my doctoral dissertation. If you want to email me, I'd be happy to send you some data on this. It's fascinating. When we feel like we've done a bad thing, a bad behavior, which is guilt, we tend to make repair. When we feel like we're basically a piece of dirt and we're horrible people, that's called shame, we tend to become more defensive, defiant, and don't look at our issues. That's why, for me, one of the problems that I think one of the significant problems our system has is that we do way too much time trying to get the people who have offended to do offense disclosures, because it's the most shame-inducing thing that we can do to them. We're actually doing probably the least therapeutic thing we can do with them. PETA. I happen to like pita bread. I'm vegetarian. But pita is, and this is important, I always like to invite, this is the one I always like to remind the supervising officers with, pita is pain in the ass. And a lot of supervising officers find that when they find a client is a pain in the ass or a parent is a pain in the ass, they all of a sudden assume everybody are psychopaths and they're higher risk. There is no correlation with being a pain in the ass and being a risk. And it's always important to invite, particularly remind supervising officers, just because myself or somebody else is being a pain in your ass doesn't mean we're higher risk and it doesn't make us a psychopath. It's important, however, to still play nicely with supervising officers. This is meta-analytic. I won't go over this, but some of the things that I've been referencing, this is basically the Tempur-Pedic mattress. Here are some of the correlations that you can look at, and again, I'm happy to talk at a later point about how those correlations relate. This is important. This is meta-analytic data. It's important that when you're looking at data, a meta-analysis is a study of studies, so there's well over 20 by now. I'm sure there's 30 to 40,000. This is relatively older data, but this data was based on a sample of over 20,000. So it's important to look at the correlations of what's there. The other thing that's important to look at, so like if I look up here, deviant sexual interest, you can see a 0.31 correlation. Mathematically, statistically, that means that about you take half of that, so deviant sexual interest accounts for about 15% of what we'd call the variance, or 15% of the pie of why people sexually offend. So even the highest risk factor doesn't have a high correlation. So the first thing to remember is there's no one single factor that predicts sexual recidivism well. You're looking at more of an accumulation. And again, the base rates are very, very low for sexual recidivism. It's anywhere. The old data has sexual recidivism rates at 5 years between 13% for child molesters up to 19% for rapists. But in Connecticut, for example, we are now on 10 years, and we've done two intervals of looking at five-year things, and the recidivism rates are around 2% in Connecticut. And I think there's a lot of states that are showing the same thing. While that's wonderful, it also tells us we need to stop being so harsh in all the rules because they are not a population that reoffends at a high level. I'm going to skip history of risk assessment. Okay, now I want to go into the three types of risk that I've referenced. First, we're going to talk about static risk. The best predictor of future behaviors is past behaviors. And that is true. When we talk about the first risk factor, the first area of risk, which is static risk, the best predictor of risk is historical factors. These are things like age of the person who's offended. It is whether it's a male or female victim. It is things like, my mind's blank. But the things that I'll show you more specifics as we go. But the best predictor of future behaviors is past behavior. So the most important thing to know about static risk is it's the best predictor of whether somebody will reoffend. Now, what's important though, static risk only tells us how likely somebody is to reoffend. It doesn't tell us how to intervene. So it only, in the system, all we know to do with static risk is to say there are high risks, so we should spend more resources, or there are low risks, so we should spend less resources. That's essentially all that it tells us. Also, really importantly, when you see a risk assessment, if you see the assessment, ignore the labels of low, medium, high. These are the worst things in the world because they're relative. If, for example, let's take, for example, alcoholism. We know that most people who are alcoholic are going to recidivate in alcohol. They're going to go and drink again. The rates are astronomical, 90 to 95%. So if somebody is a high risk to resume drinking alcohol, they're probably 90 to 95% chance they're going to do that. However, when you look at somebody who's categorized as high risk as a sexual offender, you might be talking about somebody over a five-year period whose chances of reoffending are 20%, right, or less. So what you have to look at is what's called the base rate. And the base rate is the percentage of people that we've looked at who are in this category who reoffended over a certain period of time, like 5 years or 10 years. So the base rate is really all you want to know is how many people who got this score on this risk protocol reoffended in this time period. So I would encourage you strongly to kind of ignore the concept of low, medium, high, because what we do with risk assessments is we overestimate the level of risk. When people see that somebody is a high risk for sexually offending, they start thinking, oh, we're in the 90 to 95% range, but that's not what we're talking about with sexual offense. So you want to look at the base rates. Okay, static risk. Here's some examples. Age of the offender at the time of the release. What we know is this is the most, probably the most pertinent, is the younger the person is who is offended, the more likely they are to reoffend. Basically, and I tell my 10-year-old daughter this, which is any male under the age of 25 is stupid and impulsive. And when she gets older, I'm going to tell them they're horny. Younger males tend to do stupid things, and that's what we know. The reason that the auto insurance industry raises the rates on males who are below the age of 25 is because they're more likely to do impulsive, stupid things. So it's important. It's also important, and I don't know if I'll get to be able to talk to this, there's a lot of developmental factors to look at to tie into that part of what's going on. But age of offending is the most important part of that we know in the static risk. Other things to look at is how many, what's called a sentencing occasion, which is how many criminal acts have happened. The more criminal acts have happened, the more likely somebody's to reoffend. Also, we know that if there's somebody who has a male victim, they are more likely to sexually reoffend than somebody who has a female victim. And that's not a commentary on homosexuality, it's just an empirical correlation. By the way, all this data that I'm doing assumes that the person who is offended is a male. And I thought I had more detail on the static. There may be more information come up. It looks like I'm going to switch over to the dynamic risk. The second category is dynamic risk. Dynamic risk has two subcategories, which is stable and acute. The stable dynamic risk factors are factors which are relatively consistent and enduring factors, like a social support system, like an intimate relationship. They are things that can change but don't change very often. These are probably in terms of doing supervision and treatment, these are the most important things that we look at, because these are the things that we can actually impact. It also is the area where we can individualize to a client. If, for example, a client's in a long-term, healthy, intimate relationship, we don't need to focus on that in treatment. A lot of our clients have no deviant sexual interests. They have no sexual preoccupation. They don't have any areas of the sexuality that are important, so we shouldn't be talking about that. A lot of the treatment programs will focus on, they'll have the clients talk about their fantasies on their journals every single day on the assumption that the client has a deviant sexual fantasy. But again, most of our clients don't have deviant sexual fantasies, so it's not a good use of our resources. Our cue factors are which ones can change, and I'll come back and talk about that. I'm going to skip this part. Oh, okay, that was just an overview. So I am going back to the static part, and this is the risk assessment tool that is most commonly used for static risk, and this is going to talk about the factors that are specifically there. There are other risk assessment protocols out there. And when the question comes up, if anybody wants to know about other ones, I can talk about that. I'm trying to remember. There's one out of Vermont that I don't like. It actually generally works fine. The problem is that they factored in denial as one of the risk factors, and that was really done just for political purposes. Again, it wasn't empirically correlated. The Static 2002R is the most empirically validated tool. It's clearly the best tool out there. There are other ones that have been used that work fine, but this, in my mind, you go for the best data, and this one clearly has it. Okay, so these are the main categories of static risk. One is age. Again, the younger the person is who is offended, the more likely they are to reoffend. Now, nice, and being that I'm 50, this is actually one of the few areas is working out. The older you get, this is the only area in the static risk that actually, as you get older, the risk goes down. Second area, which is persistence of sexual offending, we'll talk about this. There's three subcategories that talk about that. But it's important to look at, when you look at these five main areas of this, I'll come to that. Persistence of sexual offending, I'll talk about later. Deviant sexual interests, relationship to victims, and general criminality. Those are the main categories. And now I'll go to the subcategories of this. Age is, as I've already referenced, persistence of sexual offending, which is how many times somebody is sexually offended. Now, in this category, this only is measured with somebody who's committed a sexual offense and been convicted of it and then commits another sexual offense. That raises the risk. And this is important because we know a lot of people who have sexually offended have multiple sexual offenses and multiple victims that wasn't disclosed before their first arrest. That's called a sentencing occasion. A sentencing occasion is when you've been caught and convicted of a sexual offense. That's one sentencing occasion. Basically, some system identified you've done something wrong, and there's been a consequence to that. This is important because if you have multiple victims, that doesn't change your risk, because the empirically what we know is it's only the people who are at risk who have an intervention and then continue to go back to reoffend elevates their risk. The other ones that we look at in this are any juvenile arrests and how many sexual offenses, how often. And basically, the rule of thumb is if there's more sexual offenses, more sentencing occasions than once every 15 years, that raises the risk. These are just detailed explanations of how we look at those categories. I'm happy to talk with anybody on the side with that. Again, rates of sexual sentencing occasions is every 15 years. People who have more than one sentence every 15 years is considered a higher risk. Okay, deviant sexual interest. If somebody has a deviant sexual interest, that raises the risk. If somebody has, and what we look for here is if they have young unrelated victims, so if there's prepubescent victims, if there are male victims, let me go back one time. And if there's multiple sentencing occasions, like, for example, in this category, if you had somebody who had a contact offense against a child and they were looking at child pornography, that would raise their risk. If somebody, for example, however, looks just, and this is really common, A lot of people were getting a lot of stings on the internet. If somebody is caught for only looking at child pornography or only chatting for what they think is a child and turns out to be a cop, that actually is not a risk factor. You can't do a risk assessment on them. The risk protocol, at least the static 2002, because there isn't any empirical data to know what their risk is. This is, again, just a description of those things. Next category is relationship to victims. The general rule of thumb here when we look at static risk is the closer the relationship between the person who's offended and the person who's victimized, the lower the risk. Now, that's important because, again, a lot of times in the system people become, like if it's an incest case, people tend to really react negatively to that. But the closer the relationship, what we know empirically is that actually lowers the risk. So if you have, for example, a father who sexually offends a daughter, that risk factor is relatively low. As opposed to if you have somebody who's a stranger who has sexually offended a child in a park, which almost never happens, by the way, it's very rare, then that's actually a higher risk category. So the relationship to the victim is important in the static category, and the general rule of thumb is the closer the relationship, the lower the level of risk. And these are the sub-items that go with that. Any young victims, any unrelated victims, or any stranger victims. And these are just the definitions of that. Okay, general criminality. What we know is if people are engaged in general criminal behaviors, they are more likely to engage in sexual offense. There's a famous, he's actually a violence researcher. His name is Delbert Elliott. I think he's out of Colorado. I don't know if he's still doing the research. But basically, he looked at rape. He didn't look because he does violence, so he looked at rape. And essentially what he found was that people who were hardcore rapists, who are repeat rapists, he said basically the research said they were essentially criminals, and rape was just one entity of that. So a lot of the situations when we find, and this is important, most of the people who are sexually offended don't have high levels of criminality. However, when they do, it does raise their risk significantly. That's just the definitions for that, general criminality. These are just the scores on the static 2002R. The other thing that's important, and this is an important slide, if you look at what the rates of the five-year and, let me back up one and use an example here. So let's say we take four, a low moderate risk. Most of the clients that I see very rarely get beyond a three or four on that. And so you have a low moderate risk. If you look here, for example, of four, on a five-year, that's only 4.6% of them that are reoffending, and it's only 5.1% over 10 years. So the recidivism rates, when we talk about categories, this is what I wanted to emphasize, when we talk about categories of low, medium, or high, it's all relative, and it's important. This data here is what we call the base rates. These are the percentage of this. Now, this data, and I don't have it in here, this data has actually been enhanced, and one of the things we can now do in the risk assessments is combine the static risk with the dynamic risk to create a combined score which is even more effective. And that's important because you can lower dynamic risk. Static risk you can't change, but we now know if we lower the dynamic risk factors, we reduce the level of recidivism. And we do that, we lower dynamic risk by basically helping people be happier and healthier. Okay, so now I'm going to switch from static risk and go into the dynamic. In the dynamic risk, there's two types of dynamic risk. One is stable and one is acute. Stable factors are factors which can change over time but are typically and relatively consistent. So you have a support system. You're not likely to go change your entire support system over the weekend. You're not likely to change an intimate relationship over the weekend. It's something that will ebb and flow. Acute factors are factors which can change immediately. So let me start with the stable factors. And under the stable, there are 13 factors. There are five main categories, and there's 13 sub-items. First of all, is intimacy deficits. And this turns out to be the most important factor. What we know is that when somebody is in a healthy, intimate, long-term romantic relationship, they're pretty safe. But the key is that it's not only you're in the relationship, but it's a healthy relationship. Second is significant social influences. Social support, what we've known for a long time and we continue to find out, is that social supports are really important. This is family, this is friends, this is community involvement, this is all sorts of things that give us social connections. Third is cooperation with supervision. Clients who are more likely to cooperate with supervision are less likely to reoffend. Fourth is general self-regulation, emotional regulation, jobs, housing, finances, a lot of which, by the way, to get on the pedestal a little bit, a lot of the laws and regulations actually make this much more difficult. And then the fifth category is sexual self-regulation. And it's important, if you look at this, only one of the five main categories is under sexual self-regulation. And there are 13 sub-items, which I'm going to go through, but only three of them are sexual. One of the things is that we spend way, way, way too much time talking about sex because it's not nearly as related to, if we're going to focus on making people happy and healthy, we need to get off of these stereotypes, which are not empirically related. Okay, so let's look first at significant social influences. Is that what I want to do? I'm going to skip ahead first just to make sure I know what I'm doing here. Yep. These slides are just an overview of the 13. So here's, if you look at the left, those are the five categories, and these are the 13 subcategories, and I'll go through each of those. It is important that you have a good understanding of those, so I'll go through each one of those. But basically, this slide on the left is the five categories here that I was showing, and these are on the right of the 13 subcategories. And I'll go through each of those fairly quickly. Significant social influences. There are two things that are important when we talk about significant social influences. One, are there people who are actively involved in your life? And two, are they a good influence or a bad influence? And that's the only two things that are empirically related. I think Michael Jordan is awesome. I think he's wonderful. I text him every week, and he never texts me back. So as much as I think Michael Jordan is wonderful, the fact that he doesn't text back and connect with me doesn't make him a significant social influence. So the important thing is it's somebody who's actively engaged in your life, somebody who is positively there. The second thing is that person a positive or negative influence? Now, interestingly, it doesn't have to be that somebody has, like, for example, I have a lot of clients who have people in their social support system who have a real horrid criminal history, but it doesn't really matter. It more matters how that person approaches. For example, I might be working with a kid who's 17, 18. He's got an uncle who's got a heavy criminal record, and he says to that nephew, don't do what I did, stay on the straight and narrow. Well, if he's true to that and he lives a clean life and tries to do that now, then he's a positive influence. So you have to look at each individual. It's not necessarily somebody's in history. It's how they influence the person that we're trying to work with. Okay, second category is intimacy relationships, intimacy deficits. First thing we look for in intimate relationship is if somebody has been in a relationship for two or more years. And the research, and again, everything I'm going over with you is just basically empirical data. What we know is that if somebody has not been in a long-term intimate relationship for two or more years, it's a risk factor. And sometimes when people say, well, the client's only 17, they haven't had a chance. This is just research. It's just empirical data. It doesn't matter the age of the person who's offended if they haven't been in a long-term relationship for two or more years. And the reason we think that happens is because you learn all these interpersonal skills. Anybody can be in a three-month relationship, have lots of sex, and do lots of fun things, and just blow the sucker up, right? That's not a relationship. A long-term relationship requires things like compromise, problem-solving, emotional regulation, considering other people's points of view. So what we know empirically is that longer-term relationships are more important. So we look for length, but we're also looking for the health of the relationship. I have lots and lots and lots of clients who were intimate relationships at the time they offended, but they were really unhealthy. Healthy relationships. And an unhealthy relationship is a real high risk factor. It's a real problem. So those are the two factors when you look at the relationship, is the length of the relationships and the quality of that. Second is emotional identification. So these are subcategories under the intimacy deficits. First one was relationships, adult relationships. The second one is emotional identification with children. Now, this is an interesting factor, and a lot of my clients who have molested children fit this much better. This is different than deviant sexual interest. This is, I feel more comfortable with children than I do with adults. A lot of my clients just emotionally are more comfortable, and a lot of them feel like they were protectors of children and they were advocates for children. And at some level they really believe that. Sometimes it's real legitimate, sometimes it wasn't such a good fit. But this is feeling emotionally comfortable. Many, many more of my clients who have molested children identify with this than they do with deviant sexual interest. Sometimes both are there and it's an overlapping process. Next is problematic views of women. Now this is kind of a general, this one's a general one. It used to be called, the technical name of it is hostility towards women, but that's not really what the factor covers. This is, can be things like viewing women as sexual objects, not considering women to be equal, being angry with women. And then there's ones that happen a lot more, not trusting women, not feeling confident around women. So this can be anything where the client just has problems interacting with peer age women. General social rejection and loneliness. This happens, this is a very, very common factor with a lot of the clients. They tend to have very poor self-worth, poor self-concept. They tend to feel lonely, isolated, and they're not confident in their interpersonal skills. Frankly, you know, again, on my bandwagon a little bit, if we spent less time in treatment talking about judging them, criticizing them, what we often would want to be doing is trying to enhance their social skills, trying to enhance their esteem, trying to enhance their self-worth, helping them with their self-confidence. For me, that's a much better clinical focus than what happens a lot of times, which is just a lot of focus on the offense. Lack of concern for others. This is more of a criminality factor, which is, this isn't a lack of concern for people in general. This is a lack of concern for people in your life. If the person who's offended comes in and says, I don't trust anybody, I don't like anybody, I don't care about anybody, then you have a concern. If they're not concerned about their wife or their children or their friends or their family, or if they've just completely isolated those people because they don't care, then it's a concern. This is not the one that says, I don't like my PO, or I don't like my boss, or they're just kind of a grumpy. This is empirically, this happens when they're not feeling concern for anybody, including the people that reasonably they should. Okay. Third category is sexual self-regulation, and again, there are three subcategories under here, but most of them, they're not very common. The most common one that we see under sexual self-regulation is sexual drive and preoccupation. As I'd referenced before, a lot of our clients that I work with are the 16, 17 to 25-year-old young males, and their sexual preoccupation is astronomically high. What they get exposed to is really high. I had a client come into me a while back, and he can't have his cell phone, and he's not allowed to look at porn pictures. He says it's not so much the porn pictures. He says the problem is I can't share the porn with my friends. It's almost a bonding thing with a lot of the younger males that they can't do that. And again, I'm not advocating for it, but it's, the sexual preoccupation is much, much higher with this clientele, with this generation. Sex is coping. Now, this is an interesting one and a really important one. Sex is coping is one that looks at using sex as a way to deal with stressors. Now, I happen to think using sex to deal with stress is a pretty good thing to do. I like to encourage my girlfriend to help me with that all the time. But if that was the only thing that I did and the only way we went, it would be unhealthy. It's kind of like, you imagine the analogy would be if you had a rough week and you went and had a couple of beers or a glass of wine on a Friday night to rewind, that's perfect. That's awesome. That's terrific. But if you're using alcohol every time you feel emotionally stressed, then it's not a good thing. So the problem with sex is coping is a lot of our clients, when they feel stressed, they'll go to masturbation real commonly because it doesn't work in sexual. If you go to your partner and say, hey, dear, I'm feeling really bummed out. You want to have sex? That doesn't work very long for very often. That's not a real big turn on for most partners. So you don't, if for guys who really have sex is coping as a problem, they tend to lose partners. And so they go to pornography and masturbation. And then it becomes a cyclical thing where the only way they can deal with their emotional stressors, like somebody who might be alcoholic, is to go to masturbation and or pornography typically. And that one, sex is coping, is a relatively common factor that we see. And this is really important. Sexual preoccupation and sex is coping are much more common of the three factors that we deal with than deviant sexual interests. And I like to emphasize this because the stereotype is that anybody who's sexually offended has deviant sexual preference for children or for rape. And that is, of the three categories we see, it is by far the least common. It just is not a common factor there. Almost none of my clients over the 25 years I've done this, I certainly have a few of them who are the pedophiles or the hardcore rapists, but they don't have, most of them do not have fixated preferences, and they're not spending a lot of time doing that. And again, it's one of those areas in the system we spend way too much time trying to focus on that because we're trying to catch the bad guy really rather than trying to help people be healthy. But it's not there. Now, when it is present, it is a very significant risk factor. Okay, next is general self-regulation, which is the next category. And this is important. General self-regulation is just about how do you live your life in a healthy way. And this one is really important. I spend a lot of time with clients on this one. And there's three subcategories. One is impulsivity. Second is poor problem solving. And third is negative emotionality and hostility. So the first one, impulsivity, which is, this is not the impulsive like kind of doing something erratic. This is the impulsivity when you know this decision is going to cause you problems and you do it anyway. Okay, so this is knowing I have no money, I have all sorts of debt, and I go purchase a new car. This is getting involved in leisure activities is clearly going to cause you a problem. This is the impulsivity that when you do it, you know it's going to cause significant problems, and you do it anyway. Second is poor cognitive problem-solving abilities. This is basically somebody who has a hard time finding a job, has a hard time finding housing, has a hard time managing finances. It's basically not doing good problem-solving. And basically what happens is when people don't take care of their general lifestyle, it puts them under higher stress and they're more likely to do something stupid. That's why I try to really push in the system that we help people make good decisions and support them and understand they're under a lot of stress, especially in the beginning, and they're not as likely to make good decisions. Third is negative emotionality. And as I'd referenced before, this is a huge one. A lot of the clients, and this is a problem we're working with males, a lot of males are not comfortable talking about their emotions. But it's a really big issue because a lot of times it's manifested and we see it externally as anger, but most of the time it's the underlying factors are depression, they are anxiety, and they are trauma. That's mostly what we're dealing with. One of the biggest and most important things that I've uncovered and dealt with in the last 5 years is doing biofeedback and neurofeedback because it's a very tangible way to work with emotional regulation and dealing with emotions. This is a huge component, particularly, and this is, I try to stress this a lot, particularly when somebody comes out of prison, because the first 6 months, the highest level of risk somebody has is the first 6 months when they come out of prison. They're trying to find jobs, they're trying to find housing, they're trying to reintegrate their system, they're lonely, they're rejected, they're getting criticized. It's a huge time. So for me, that's a time to really focus on the emotionality. This is kind of personal. I wasn't going to share this, but this has happened to me 4 times in my life, and I think it's important to know. And I think it's important to share this because people don't take the emotionality serious enough. I had a client on Friday. It's just so fresh. On Friday, I had a young lady come in. She was 25 years old. Her father brought in, and she had severely depressed. Dad had to bring her in. I gave her my card and said, look, we'll start sessions on Monday. And she was tearful. She was coming in. but she agreed to do the therapy. Sunday night, she killed herself. And that's the fourth time it's happened in my career. And every time it happens, it just tears your heart out. And I think it's important to bring that out, that we don't know how much stress our clients are under. The one of the things that I think is really tragic in the system and what happens with when we create these labels is we don't appreciate how much stress our clients are under and how emotionally distressed they are. It's really, really important to understand that these are trauma. Most of the clients that we're dealing with who are sexually offended did commit the sexual offense, and they have caused serious damage to other people a lot of times. But that doesn't mean that they don't have trauma. And we have to get over a lot of these labels so that we can help make sure that these people are healthier. We don't want other people doing, most of the time they don't go to the level of suicide, but sometimes they do. But the emotionality is huge, and it's something, for me, it's the first thing we should be dealing with in the system, not an afterthought. Next category is cooperation with supervision. What we know is, even though pain in the ass is not a risk factor, if people do not cooperate with supervision, it does increase their risk. Partly, a lot of times it's antisocial behaviors, but also, and I really encourage this with new clients, is that if they can't integrate in the system and accept, and frankly, a lot of the rules, and I don't mind saying this to anybody, a lot of the system rules are just stupid. But with that said, if you've been said, here's what your rules are, you still have to follow them. Because I've led to have a job that I haven't found stupid rules and jobs either. You still got to follow them. So it's important that we work with the people we're talking about, which is whether you agree with the rules or not, there's ways to meaningfully advocate for that. But when the rules are there, it's really important that you follow them. Because what we know is when people can't adjust and integrate to deal with those rules, a lot of times there's a lot of recidivism happens. Okay, last factor, I'm going to go to the third category, which is acute risk. Now, these are risk factors that occur in the moment. So these are the things that happen immediately that we look at. One is victim access. Now, it's important. I have a lot of battles with probation and parole officers. Victim access is the first one in here. A lot of times, probation officers and victim advocates will say, for example, victim advocate access is any child. And that's not necessarily the case. I had a client last week, and he was caught for child pornography, and he had looked at a picture in a JCPenney catalog. He'd purposely done it. He's a pedophile. And she'd said, you've offended a victim because you looked in a JCPenney catalog. And we had to kind of say to her, no, it was a risk factor, but it wasn't direct victim access. So this is really talking about access to somebody that they can hurt in the moment. Second is hostility. What we know is when the emotional regulation gets to the point, particularly with males, when aggression and hostility comes out, their risk significantly increases in the moment. Now, the important thing about the acute factors is that you're trying to deal with it in the moment, and it's something you want to bring down fairly quickly. Third is, and some of these will cross over between the dynamic between the stable and the acute, is sexual preoccupation. If somebody is in the moment, and we see this a lot of times sexual preoccupation is cyclical. So somebody might not look at pornography for a long time, and then all of a sudden they're looking at 2 or 3 hours a night every night, and they're masturbating 2 or 3 times a day. So they might go into a cyclical process where the preoccupation comes in and out. And usually it's associated with something like rejection, loneliness, whatever it is. Reject supervision. This is directly, you know, telling your PO to go screw off or something like that. It's a direct confrontation or direct not showing up for supervision. Something specifically defined. Next is emotional collapse. And this is not just be emotionally misregulated, but emotionally collapsing. Whatever happened to that girl on Sunday night when she killed herself, she really collapsed in that moment. Whatever that horrible moment was for her, she just really went down and spiraled fast. And a lot of times we find this with clients, particularly with males, because they don't tend to regulate their emotions well, is that they can lose it pretty quickly. And a lot of times I have to coach the clients when they're feeling really angry. One of my favorite sayings, and when I worked in the prison, the favorite acronym I ever got was HALT, which is hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Whenever you're feeling hungry, angry, lonely, tired, stop. And one of the most important tools I try to give to a client is always stop, because you always make a better decision down the road. Particularly with the younger clients, this is a hard one. to the, oh, by the way, we added S, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, or sexual. So if we tell the client you're overly sexual, stop. Give yourself some time, cool off. Adrenaline in the system, in the body, can only fire off for about 20 minutes. So anybody who gets raging mad can only stay raging mad for 20 minutes. Physiologically, we can't hold on to extreme emotions for more than that. So I tell clients, hang on for 20 minutes. You know, there's nothing that has to be decided that can't be decided 20 minutes later or 20 hours later. You always, always make better decisions through time. Next is social support collapse, losing a friend, losing a family member, that type of thing. And this happens, I even categorize in here things like jobs. One of the interesting, one of the sadder things that I see with clients is a lot of times, one of the hard moments is when a client has gone out and they think that they've gotten the job and they get the job and they were so hard to get the job and then all of a sudden a background check comes back in or some higher level manager finds out about their fence and they've started their first day and then all of a sudden the job is pulled out from them. It's a really hard moment for them and it's really tough because finding jobs can be very tough for clients in this area. But it's something like that, losing a friend, losing a family member. And again, in the first 6 months we see a lot of this. They find out who their friends are, they find out who the people are going to stick with them, and a lot of times they lose that, and that's a hard, hard time for them. And then finally, substance abuse. Even though it's not an ongoing risk factor, somebody who gets high in the moment or gets really drunk in the moment can be stupid if other factors are available. I won't go through each of these. This is just a definition of each of those. And then when we do the risk assessment for acute summaries, it goes into two general categories, and this is how we break them up into what is their, did I get them all? There it is. We break it into two categories. What is your risk for sexual violence, or what's your risk for general recidivism? And that's how the categories break up into where they empirically are most risk for that. So you can see, for example, when we're worrying about sexual recidivism, victim access, hostility, sexual preoccupation, and rejection of supervision, those are the ones who are most correlated with that. Now, again, it's important to know that when we talk about these are risk factors and these are the best, it's just statistical significance. You could have somebody who has substance abuse like my exposure, and when he abuses, he's at higher risk for sex because substance abuse fits for him. But in general, these are how the categories fit. These are just the levels. There's two different ways that we look at acute risk assessment. One is what's the severity in the moment. So, for example, if we're talking about, let's say, rejection of supervision. So no problem is they go in and they're fine with the PO. One might be maybe a problem where the client says to the PO, the probation officer, I'm not happy about these rules. I don't like these rules. I want to talk about it. That's considered maybe a problem because you always want to note if there's even a slightest rejection, you want to note that. It's not to criticize them, but we know from a risk point of view that's an issue. Now, yes, the concern would be the client may say to the probation officer, I don't like these rules, and I'm not going to follow them. Now we've got a serious issue. Now they're being openly defiant, and from a risk point of view, that significantly elevates their risk. Finally is what we call intervene now. This is a client that says to the probation officer, I don't like your rules, I'm not following them, and when we get out of here, I'm going to kick your ass. Now it's something where you're at an acute level of danger. So one way we look at acute is we look at the level of risk in the moment. You could do another example of access to victims. You could say you're walking down the street and the victim range that the person offended is 6 to 8. So maybe they're going by and they happen to go into a frozen yogurt place and there's a bunch of six-year-olds in there. Okay, so that might be a one. Or you go into a grocery store. Two may be where the client specifically goes to an area like a daycare. And they go in, there's a clear concern here. Client made a specific, or they go into a park with a playground, and they specifically gone there to be around children. Third is intervene now would be something like the client gets himself alone with a small child. So one area you look at is the acuteness of it. And most importantly, most of the time when we get acute systems, it's usually a one that we're dealing with. Now, the best way, and this is a little confusing, is not to look when we're trying to predict risk. This actually doesn't happen a lot, and most of the times this doesn't lead to sexual offending. The best area to consider acute is how often does that happen over time. Let me give you an example. If, for example, somebody says, let's go back to rejection of supervision. If somebody says, I don't want to follow the rules. In the first couple of weeks of supervision, that makes sense. Most guys that come out of prison and they get under supervision don't like all the rules, and I wouldn't either if I had all those rules imposed. And so they say something, and they don't like it, but then they adjust after a few weeks. But if the client week after week after week says, I don't like this rule, I don't like this rule, I don't like this rule, over time, that's actually a better prediction of somebody who's not going to follow the rules than somebody who has a real bad moment and may say something really stupid in 1 week. That will really set off a probation officer, but what's a bigger concern is whether somebody adjusts or doesn't adjust to that. Okay. Okay. Well, that's basically it. I'm open to any thoughts or questions if there are any out there.
I would like to thank Dr. Wallace. If anyone wants to get into the Q&A, we'll start that now. And I think I would like to just start by asking you a question if I could.
Sure.
What is your advice? Most of the people on this call are, like me, people who've been affected by laws negatively with the registry and that kind of thing.
Right.
And a lot of us probably have seen some real negative experiences around counseling, the services that offenders receive. So what is your advice to someone like me or any of us on this call who are advocates about how we advocate for the kind of therapy, kind of services that you just described?
Well, a couple of things I would suggest. As much as you can, use empirical data. Because the system is supposed to be guided, and really, when I say the system, I'm talking about supervision and treatment. That funding, there's been a lot of research and a lot of push towards following empirically based factors. So I think that that's important to do is to, first of all, the better you know the research, the better you, and I've provided you with some of that in here. That should arm you with that. For example, if a treatment program focuses on denial and they keep doing offense disclosure over and over and the client says, I don't like this, at some point it's good to arm people and say that there's no research that says doing accountability does anything to help. Why are you having my son continue to do offense disclosures every week or whatever it is? Now, if you're talking bigger picture, things like registries, which, by the way, that's a whole different discussion. Registries, I'm sure most of you know this, but the research is very clear. Registries do essentially nothing to reduce risk, to reduce recidivism rates. They also don't, in most cases, do anything to harm it, to increase risk. They're basically a null effect, but there is research, and there's a, what's her name,
Levinson.
Jill Levinson, thank you. Her research is very clear. There's a lot of negative impacts that the registry has, both emotional but also real practical things, which I'm sure you're all acutely aware of. One of the biggest problems with the registry is that people can't get housing. The jobs it doesn't affect as much because background checks is what causes that problem. The registry really causes problem on a practical basis. It causes problems because when somebody says, I want to live in this apartment, and the landlord says, oh, I'm going to be on the registry, they're all done. They can't get housing. That's our big problem in Connecticut. So really what you want to advocate in registries is that you want to have a risk-based registry. So all the things that I've explained to you, in a system that's operating properly, the registry should be based on the level of risk of the person who's offended. And the vast majority of them are low-risk clients, which means they shouldn't be, for example, on an internet base. In my estimate, and really what the research would say is, low-risk offenders should be on registries, that is, the police know about it, and if they live like near a daycare or school that's a particular risk, then they're specifically notified. But the general public has no reason and no benefit to knowing that stuff, and it just causes more problems. So what I would suggest to you is to know what the research is and to use that as much as you can to your benefit. The other thing, and this is not to be critical, because I'm very much an advocate for what you guys do, but your perception is that you are being soft on crime and you're only trying to advocate for your person that's been impacted. And at some level, that's where I would be also, but you want to detach that as much as possible so that people take you as seriously as they can. best way you can do that is to use the research. Don't go too much, would be my advice, on your individual case, because the system will tend to discount that. They're looking at bigger picture things. The more you can use the research and the more you can say here or use logic why this doesn't fit, I think the more powerful you'll be.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go to our first question now, who is Carol.
We thank
you. Is Carol there?
Thanks so much for this presentation. I'm also a psychologist, retired, and you're talking to us like we're talking to reasonable people. So I recently had an experience where I found out about the use of, in our state, they're using the static 99 and the stable 2000.
Yep.
But in our state, there's almost no one with any clinical training doing treatment. It is like, I know in our county, and as I've gone up the chain of command, it's often social workers, not clinical social workers, and almost all the treatment's done by students. So they have this manual, and when I try to talk with them about, I talk with the student and the supervisor about some of the research, they... It's like, who the hell do you think you're talking to? How dare you ask us? And they, you know, I hate to say it, but sometimes a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. They see it as the Bible, and, you know, suddenly someone who's always been low risk is high risk because of this tool. And I wonder if you could speak to the issue of the relationship between the person doing the assessment and the registrant, and if, you know, what impact that has on scoring, because some of these things seem pretty subjective.
Well, they shouldn't be. The tools, actually, the static 99, which is fine to use, the static 99 and the, I think you said the stable 2000,
yes.
Those are fine to use. I would first want to know why they're not using, one warning sign is, this was a criticism. I left the agency that I was at because I didn't like the treatment services. The person took over. We were using the stable 2002, and he went back to using the static 2002R.
Right.
He went back
mm-hmm.
to using the static 99, and the reason was for exactly what you're referencing, which is he didn't feel it was easier to score. And I said, but it's not the best data. We need to
right.
talk to a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always a warning sign if somebody's not using the most updated tools that they're mm-hmm. probably doing it because it's easier to score. And it isn't
mm-hmm.
that hard to score the static 2002.
Mm-hmm.
What I would say is if it's subjective, they're not doing it correctly. All of the tools have pretty, especially the static 99, and the static tool is a very easy tool. It actually was designed for probation officers to complete. But as
right.
stable, they
yes.
were designed for probation officers to fill out. So they weren't designed for people to have high levels of training to do that. If it's subjective, they're not doing it right. And again, one of the things I would come back to is if they're saying somebody's like high risk, I would come back to trying to explain to them, well, how is it criminogenic, and really, is it high? If it's in a category of high, what I would push to them is, what's the base rate? If you said this person's high risk, what's the base rate?
Right.
One of the problems that I experience a lot is that we'll have professionals here who will say a client's a high risk, but they didn't do a risk protocol on them. They didn't do a risk assessment on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just, a lot of times it's that PETA problem that I referenced. They find the client to be a pain in the ass, and so they say, oh,
mm-hmm.
well, you're not making me happy, you're not telling me what I want to hear, or you're in denial,
mm-hmm.
so I consider to be high risk. That's the language that's thrown a lot around a lot, which is high risk or dangerous or psychopath, which most of the time, if they were using the tools, which they're likely not, it's not well grounded, because most of these clients are low risk clients. And if they are high, it's not always necessarily a ongoing thing. It's something that can be addressed, like it's a dynamic factor.
Well, just one last comment. In Pennsylvania, there are the only authorized programs are for sexually violent predators, and they make everyone, all the risk levels go to those. And I don't know if other people in other states have dealt with issues like this. Do we approach the legislature? Do we talk to the probation and parole board to try to get some of these things changed? Like, what would you recommend?
Well, the first warning sign you have is just by the label, sexually violent predators.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, if they were going to follow that, that's essentially nobody. It's statistically, that number of people who are would fit into that, who have sexually offended, are almost none of the clients. You'd have, in Pennsylvania, you'd have 5 people in treatment, right? So just, again, it's one of those things that politicians like to do and people like to do, which
mm-hmm.
is they talk about violence and predators, but that's not the, what I try to always do is go to the behaviors. That's
okay.
not the behaviors of these clients. 90 to 95% of them were people that they knew. And they weren't predatory, and they weren't violent. That doesn't mean that there wasn't trauma and there isn't something to deal with. But that's kind of your first thing to know, is that's the bias you're dealing with up front. But yes, I think that a lot of times what you're trying to do is, and it's an uphill battle. I tell my clients all the time, this is the last scarlet letter that we really have in this society.
Exactly.
It's just to be a sex offender. It's the mm-hmm. one category where people can continue to beat up on this population and everybody's okay with it. Right,
mm-hmm.
It's the one area. So I think that, so it's beyond an uphill battle. I don't want to discourage people, but society's not going to change this one easily, and you really don't have a good population to help with this. The best you have is the research and the facts. And the facts are very clear. This is a low-risk population that is very likely not to sexually reoffend and very unlikely to do other general criminal behaviors. These are generally people who fit very well within society. I've known for 25 years, the dirty secret is, everybody says, oh, you work with criminals. That's not really. Not really.
Mm-hmm.
I don't work with antisocials very rarely. So for me, my recommendation to you is equip yourself with the best research you can, stick to behavior, stick to facts, and refute things that are pejorative comments like predatory or sexually violent, because that's not reality. Very few clients fit into that protocol.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right. We have one more person in the queue.
Hi, this is Scott Morgan from Illinois Voices. Thanks for your presentation. Just briefly, I wanted to make mention that in the state of Illinois, we have a bill that's been sent to the governor that we're waiting for a signature right now. It's proposing to create a task force that's charged with examining current offenses that require registration and the current data and research regarding evidence-based practices. Presumably, the task force will be looking to set up a risk assessment system to better direct the state's resources to basically the way they spun the bill to get it through the General Assembly was that it's a get tough on crime bill. Let's make sure that we deal most effectively. Let's deal more with the most violent, high risk offenders. But what they didn't say is what they're looking to do is tailor the laws a little better. A couple of facts I want to tell you, and then a couple of questions. Pretty much in Illinois, anyone with an offense against a minor is prohibited from being in a park. Can't live within 500 feet of a school, daycare, playground, facility providing programs to minors. And most are on the registry for life, and there's no provision for adult offenders to petition off the registry. What I'm wondering is, because I know that there's this Connecticut Special Committee on Sex Offenders, and I'm sorry if I missed the beginning of the presentation. Did you testify to that committee and give recommendations?
I did, and I actually dropped out of that committee because it's in Connecticut, it's the same political thing here. So I was part of that committee, and I dropped out because, frankly, it was a waste of time.
So you were on the committee? Like, you had a seat on the committee?
Yes. I have an impulse control problem, so when I see stupid, I just walk away. So it was the same thing. And what happens is, now, if you're going to make those things work, the tactic they're using is the right approach to this. And this is factually based. You do want, this is the risk needs responsibility model. The research is very clear. You do want to focus on more attention to the higher risk clients. And that is how you can get it through legislatures, which is that is get tough on crime because you're going to be more effective. What you're not saying is you'll spend less time and less resources on the people who are lower risk, which is the vast majority of clients. But all of us should be in sync with that. That's the best research. If you have somebody who's a predator or a pedophile or highly fixated and highly dangerous, we should put a lot of resources in them. But because resources are limited, that means that, and not only because resources are limited, it's the research is very clear. When we put a lot of resources, a lot of time, and a lot of energy into low-risk clients, we elevate their risk. We're making mm-hmm. them more dangerous. If we keep somebody in treatment for 26.9
right.
months, we elevate. It's also good to do what you're saying in the registry, which is to what you're wanting to do is make it a risk base. Now, the most important thing, and this is the problem, because a lot of places don't have the built-in resources for that, you don't want to set, you don't want a risk base only based on static risk because it doesn't change. So once
right.
you've done
that's
a static,
that's what they did in Oregon. Understanding that they're just using the static 99 right now to classify offenders in that state,
which is a shame because they're required to do a dynamic risk appraisal every year in Oregon. So it's a shame that they don't integrate that in because Oregon's one of the few places that actually does. All the providers there are required to do once a year a dynamic risk. Well, why they don't incorporate that in
yeah.
is beyond me. But you don't want to have a system that has just static because
right.
anybody who's elevated can't get off of it.
Did you submit specific recommendations, even though you're not liking how that committee's being run? Did you submit
yeah.
specific recommendations to them then on what they should do and how they should go about doing it?
Yes, a couple things. First of all, be careful not to have the evaluator and the treatment provider be the same person because you get lots of homerism, right? That, in, for example, in Connecticut, the program I used to oversee, which I left a couple years ago, they make a referral. 100% of the clients they refer, they evaluate every single client and they treat every client. And they refer every single client to treatment. Right, so it's a good business model for them, but it doesn't necessarily fit. So the evaluator, in the ideal, I'll tell you what the ideal system would be, is that your evaluator is neutral. It's not paid from the defense. It's not paid from the prosecution. You would have you'd have a separate funding where the evaluator is neutral and it's different than the treatment provider. You're not going to get that. That's kind of gold standard. But that's what you want people to think about, is the independence that because a lot of evaluations are biased. If the prosecution is doing it, it's geared one way. If the defense is doing it, it's a different way. So you want that to be neutral, and you want it to be separate from that. You won't get that, but it gets people thinking about where biases come into place. More importantly, on my point of view, is that you want the static and the dynamic factors factored in, and the dynamic factors need to be evaluated on a yearly basis. This is why it's hard
right.
to get it through the state, because one, you have to have the resources, which isn't actually that hard. You need to have the resources to reappraise the dynamic risk factors every year, but then you have to have the resources to have, if there's going to be a registry, that registry reconsiders the risk for that person. Minnesota has a good model. I think the people from Minnesota came out and testified, and it was mm-hmm. like their registry has like 100 and some people on it. That's it. I don't remember the exact number, but it's like a low 100 number
mm-hmm.
because most of their clients they recognize are low risk and they don't put their resources there. Connecticut, we've got thousands. Most states have thousands, like 20,000 people on a registry, which is just nonsense because
yeah.
the numbers get so high you can't practically do anything with it.
I think we have 27,000 on the Illinois registry. But
and that's also a good, one of the ways you want to get law enforcement in place is saying, look, we want our law enforcement to focus on, we don't want them chasing around low-risk people. We want our law enforcement and our supervising officers to focus on the high-risk clients. And if you give them 27,000, that's totally impractical.
Is there the recommendations available online somewhere, so that ones that you've written up or provided?
If you email me, I'm sure that I have them written someplace, and I'd be happy to send them to you.
Okay, thank you. Or readjust them.
But those are the kind of the basics. The most important thing is to make it a risk-based one and use dynamic risk factors. That's the most important part.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, Brenda.
Yes,
we have one more person in the queue. So,
yeah, this is Brenda. I just wanted to ask a question that came in. You mentioned your email, Dr. Wallace, and if you could perhaps share, if you're willing to share that with us here on the call,
Sure.
And then also, do you have an online presence, such as a website or a blog or anything that people could go and look at?
I do. My website is so poorly kept up, so I wouldn't even want you to go there. But you can if you want. There's actually a little bit of stuff on there. My email, which is the best way to reach me, is Dr. Randall. So it's drrandall@hotmail.com, which should be easy. My brothers informed me I am the last person on the planet to have a Hotmail account, but I'm not giving it up. So it's relatively easy to get me. It's drrandall@hotmail.com.
Okay, thank you. I'm seeing, so you say there's one more question, Jen?
There's one more question, and before we do that, I'm going to put in a plug here. I think Dr. Wallace's presentation has been fabulous tonight, very informative, and I am responsible for organizing our advancing advocacy sessions every month, and I sure could use some help. So if there's anybody on this call tonight who would be willing to step up and help me do this. I typically kind of run month by month. It'd be nice to have some help where we could really be planning 2, 3, 4 months out. So I'm not always scrambling at the last minute to find some excellent presenters like this one. So if you want to continue to have these excellent presentations, it would be great to have some help. So with that said, I'm going to go to the next question, and we will finish up with this. Are you there?
We should. Not sure we have the person.
The 203 number.
Here, I'll click. There we go.
Can you click? Did it?
Oh, Brenda, it's Cindy.
There we go.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. Can hear you now.
Everybody, it's Cindy from Connecticut. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Cindy. How are you?
Good. Good. Glad to. Fantastic. Thank you so much for tonight. Randy, by the way, has, volunteered at some point. I'm working with the Juvenile Justice Political Oversight Committee. And even though the Raise the Age initiative was put out, the flame was put out this year, it'll be back next year. And he's offered to come in and do a presentation because a lot of people would like to keep sexual offenders of sex assault too off the Raise the Age, which says that if you're 21 or under, you could be adjudicated in a juvenile court. And the victims' advocates would like to keep all sexual offenders in adult courts for obvious reasons. So anyway, Randy's offered to help us with that. I wanted to ask Randy, and then I just wanted to comment on something with Scott. The substance abuse, the acute factor, when you talk about the person being high in the moment, you're not even really talking about it being a drug or alcohol. It's just that we're so over, we can't regulate or balance our emotions. I mean, I've had emotional hangovers before, because I get so high and low.
Right.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about. Were you specifically talking substance abuse or just the feelings?
Well, that's what the research says. Now, a couple of things that I would really, really want to go back to, it's a good question, Cindy, is one of the things that I would really want you to go back to is, remember when we talk about these risk factors, most of the time, these factors are not good predictors of risk. Because somebody gets high on a Friday night doesn't mean they're going to go out and find a small child and molest them. In a bad situation where somebody might be left alone with a child and they get high and you put a series of combinations of getting together, something wrong can happen. But most of the time, these factors, what happens in the system is that most of the time the system way overreacts to it. And what I try to, if you were going to understand any concept that I've talked about today, go back to the slide on criminogenic. Because you want to, then this is where you're going to make arguments with the system about just because it's on a risk factor doesn't mean that it was criminogenic for this client. Just because this client looked at some porn or drank a beer means that they're going to go molest a child. So the criminogenic is important to understand that, is it related to the research? Does it apply to this client? And was it relevant in that situation? So any of these things, what, and I remember the psychologist had mentioned that, you know, it was my experience where people don't tend to be well educated. A lot of times people are making decisions in the system, the therapist, the probation or parole officer, or the victim advocate, they're advocating for things that really are more tied to their biases than they are to the research. They're tied into these stereotypes of who they think people are as sexual offenders, where what we know about sexual offending, it's an extremely heterogeneous population. The reasons they offend, their levels of risk, their types of risks, all of those things are very different. You know, the 18-year-old kid who has sex with a 15-year-old girl is very, very different than the 45-year-old fixated pedophile who's interested in six-year-olds. Yet they get categorized into the same clump. So how you counteract that is to focus on the criminogenic factors, what's relevant to this particular person, and try to get the system away from generalizing, which is what they tend to do. The system tends to be, frankly, lazy, sloppy, and very judgmental. You have to use the research to really slow them down and say, here's what's relevant to this individual person.
Yeah. I just wanted to comment about what Scott was talking about. I was on the phone with an executive director of one of our top three organizations. Like, we have, you know, what is it, Court Support Services, CCSD, and Department of Correction, and I think the other one would be Pardons and Parole. Perhaps those are the three big ones. Anyway, from his perspective, we're going forward with a risk assessment tool. And what we hope to get by it is that it would, you know, it would start to get used, and I don't know how, because not the criminal defense attorneys will have a say in this, but it would get used possibly around the pre-sentencing stage. And the risk assessment tool will follow a person through the different stages through to, you know, whether the person is eligible for diversionary programs, AR, if incarcerated, how the person will be managed post-incarceration, et cetera. Now, that sounded great because that's a start to look at people as individuals and to treat them at all the different levels as individuals. And then I go to a meeting today with the, it was a subcommittee on victims and community resources, and one of the people that runs parole and special parole talked about adding a piece of information to the registry. Maybe the public would be happy if we put down the name of the person managing the offender. And it was like, you know, yes, we want to go backwards five steps. You know, it's just amazing. And the one thing that keeps me sane is how illogical the entire system is. You know, and one of our members likes to call the people morons. And I mean, I hate to say it, but that was the tone of the meeting today. So anyway.
Well, it does, and it does go in, Cindy. It's important to remember that if you guys are going to battle this, you have to keep your heads calm and you have to use behaviors and research, because you're dealing with all sorts of biases and you guys are perceived as soft on crime and only advocating for people who shouldn't be advocated for. So you have to rise above that. Use the research, use the data, use facts, use logic. Because the one thing that's really clear is that most of our system issues, most of our policies have no basis in empirical reality, and they're just prejudices, biases. The research clearly says we are not doing it the right way.
Yeah. No, you gave me a good refresher course today. It's got to be based on the facts.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Cindy.
Thanks, Brenda.
Bye. Do you believe we've heard from everybody? Am I right on that, Jennifer? I think we've hit them all.
Brenda, I think we have one last one. Do we have one, just one more?
Maybe. Our Q and AQ is kind of mixed up.
And I don't We had a call 720 number.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and we'll double check here. Have you already said hello?
Hi, yes, it's Georgina. I do have a question.
All right.
Okay, it's Georgina from South Dakota, and my question is, I've been attending our task force meetings here in South Dakota and was told that we do not have any sexual behavior therapist in the state of South Dakota. Who can I refer them to get the education that Dr. Wallace has?
The place that you there's the first place to go is to there's a professional organization. It's a very good organization. The nice thing about our field is it's pretty consolidated. So the best website to go to is called ATSA.com, and you can contact them directly, and they may have providers. I think they have a provider list, but they're also very friendly. You can just call them and say, we're looking for providers in this area. By the way, I'd also like to plug a book that I would encourage you guys to read. It's a little technical, and it's therapy, and it's clinical. But if you want to know what good therapy looks like, my hero, one of my many heroes in this field, is a guy named Bill Marshall, so William Marshall. And I'm trying to remember the exact name of the book, but it's something to the point of strength-based treatment for sexual offenders. It's something to that effect. So if you do a Google of William Marshall, M-A-R...
Out of Canada?
Yes, Bill Marshall's out of Canada. Terrific, terrific researcher. He's been in this field for 40 years. Wonderful, brilliant guy. He's been one of our leading things. And he's really transformed. He's always been one of the transformative figures in this field, and he's written about, now a lot of it's clinical stuff, but it gives you the conceptual idea of how you want to do treatment. And I really think everything should based on strengths. And so and you can develop all sorts of things that are based, even in the supervision, that is much more strength-based. That's a book that I would need. I think it's real important that you understand the concept of risk, needs, responsivity, which is an empirical model of how you, that's Andrews and Bonta. That their research is very fundamental to how the system operates, which is, and this is how you kind of go after things like registries and those types of things, which is research is extremely simple and clear. Higher risk people need more resources, lower risk people need fewer resources. And if you keep coming back to that, what you will find is that people who sexually offend, the research will say over and over again, and the risk will say, low risk, low risk. And don't let them just use the category. You should push them to use base rates, because different risk assessment tools can say somebody who offends at a 10% rate over 10 years is a high risk, right? It's all relative. So you have to, when somebody uses a category, know what the base rate is. Don't fall for just what the category is. You have to know what the base rate is. What percentage of people who have this score have sexually reoffended in whatever time period you're looking at? That's important, because that's how one way you can keep too many people in the system, by simply changing the category.
All right. I appreciate that information, and thank you so much for this evening. I really enjoyed your presentation, so thank you very much.
Thank you. And then just again, also on behalf of RSOL, I want to say thanks so much for coming to you, and we've certainly enjoyed it, and we will, I think at this point, go ahead and sign off and turn off our recording and our Q&A. Have a good evening, everyone, and look forward to, stay tuned. We're not quite sure what we're doing next month, but we'll get you informed as soon as possible. Thank you very much.
Good luck to all of you.
Yeah, thank you. Good evening.